I'm Alex Marlowe, and this is the Breitbart News Daily Podcast. It's an atypical show today as we begin with a guest, the brilliant Ken Klukowski, a senior legal contributor for us at Breitbart News and a Trump administration alumnus. He breaks down all the crucial details of the unprecedented leak of the apparent draft Supreme Court opinion that perhaps would overturn abortion law as we know it. This could turn into the biggest story of the decade. We also touch on what might happen next in the law and the culture as some on the left passionately insist that the right to terminate life in the womb is sacred. Gruesome, gross, somewhat bizarre, yet sadly mainstream in the year 2022. Then we speak to Senator Marsha Blackburn about being the lone pro-life woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee. We get her reaction to the big breaking SCOTUS news. Then we get into the latest on the Biden Ministry of Truth, shocking illegal alien border crossing numbers, and so much more right now. Last night, something happened that was truly unbelievable. There was a massive breach of Supreme Court norms and protocols with a leak of a draft opinion. And we don't know necessarily if the opinion was going to be a majority opinion or a minority opinion. It certainly seems to read at first glance like a majority opinion of a ruling that would overrule Roe versus Wade, the most controversial, I would say, of any of the Supreme Court decisions of all time, and the one that engenders the most passion, shall we say, on both sides of the political aisle, one that is a unifier for both the right and the left for different reasons. And the intention from this opinion would be that Roe v. Wade is overturned. In fact, key passage, we hold that Roe v. Wade must be overruled. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision, including the one on which the defenders of Roe and Casey, another significant case that we'll hear about in a moment, now chiefly rely, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. That provision has been held to guarantee some rights that are not mentioned in the Constitution, but any such right must be, quote, deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions, close quote, and, quote, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, close quote. The right to the abortion does not fall into this category. And it continues from there. Very well written, seems very well argued, comprehensively done if it's real, which, of course, it's hard to know for sure if it's real. Not because it doesn't look real, certainly does, but because in the Supreme Court's history, we've never had a leak this significant, literally the biggest one ever, and it is a massive breach of confidence and trust of not just the nine justices, but there's only about 45 or so individuals on the planet who would have had access to this document prior to the release yesterday, which is why it is truly shocking. So we're going to hear all about it from Ken momentarily, but I will offer my quick take is this is clearly an effort to try to intimidate any justices who would be fence sitting should this opinion become be in a position to become the law of the land. And the fact that this leak took place is nothing short of an insurrection. It is nothing short of a war on our democracy as we know it. It's an effort to undermine the court. It's an effort to undermine your vote. Those of you who voted for people who put the members on the court who are there now. And this is has a clear indication that the goal of mine from the left is to persuade those who are in charge at this time, which is despite what how it feels in the country sometimes, is Joe Biden and the Democrats in the Senate and in the House, like Nancy Pelosi, to end the filibuster, pack the court, and thus they will have a massive win, even if the November elections go as disastrously for them as they could. And that will take not just votes, but it will take a lot of political capital, which as of now, they do not have. They do not have that political capital to end the filibuster and pack the court. So we will see if I'm being hysterical in a moment, because Ken knows more than just about anyone I know on this topic. And he's written the brilliant lead story at Breitbart.com now, which has all the information you need pretty much. But I will try to unpack it with you for the radio audience. So Ken, good morning. Thanks for getting up early with me. This is the earliest we've had a guest in a very long time. Maybe once in the last year, but truly important. And I'm sure you've had a very busy night trying to figure out what's going on. This is an amazing moment for two reasons, because you and I are both part of the pro-life community, shall we say, and so this could potentially be good news in a way, but personally, on a personal level, I'll tell you, and this is purely emotional, considering the makeup of the court and considering Donald Trump's victory and the nature of him getting the three Supreme Court picks, it does not totally shock me that the Roe versus Wade was on the chopping block. In fact, I think thoughtful legal minds who are liberal, who are even on the left, would have seen that coming, given the makeup of the current court. What is truly shocking, this is actually where I want to begin, is the nature of the leak. What do we know about the leak, both in terms of the literal leak, but also in the historical significance of it?
You're right. You and I are both pro-lifers. We have been for a long time. I have worked on the rights of the unborn in abortion litigation in previous cases, including at the Supreme Court level. My family has marched in the March for Life downtown in Washington, D.C. So after all this, 50 years, a half century, after Roe v. Wade was handed down by the Supreme Court, we are on the cusp right now looking at the Supreme Court, at least tentatively, at least if this continues on course, correcting one of the worst mistakes that the court ever made, correcting a half century of a misinterpretation of the Constitution. And as Justice Alito said in this opinion that was leaked, that it's time for the court, as he puts it, to heed the Constitution, accepting that there is nothing in the Constitution that speaks of a right to abortion, and therefore overrule Roe v. Wade and its successor, Casey v. Planned Parenthood, and return this issue to the American people to decide it in elections and through their elected leaders. That's exactly what we're looking at here. And I'll start beyond that with one comment to what you said. And that is, when I first heard this story, and when I first engaged with the Breitbart team to try and, we have to write on this, the first thought that came to my mind as I saw the leaked story headline was, well, this could totally be false. This could be a fabricated story. We all remember, those of us who are old enough remember the National Guard documents in the 2004 presidential election against George W. Bush, and turned out it was all fabricated. But as soon as I saw it, I've read hundreds, maybe a thousand Supreme Court opinions in my time. And Supreme Court opinions are so large, and there's so much in them. And it's like when the government is training people to recognize counterfeit currency, a big part of their training is just studying real dollar bills in tremendous detail. When you deal with Supreme Court decisions enough, you know what they're supposed to look like. And as soon as, when I was 2 minutes into the draft, I realized, I'm like, oh my goodness, this looks authentic. This reads the way a Supreme Court opinion would read in general. And also, each of the nine justices have their own voice. I've read hundreds of Alito opinions. This read like an Alito opinion. So I realized very quickly that I was confident that this is an authentic document. And then it just created this astounding scandal. This will be in the history books, that someone betrayed their oath to maintain the confidentiality of the court and actually leaked this to the media in an attempt to subvert the work of the Supreme Court, in an attack on the constitutional order itself. It's just astounding.
So, Ken, how could this happen? What are the mechanics of it, and why hasn't it happened in the past?
Well, the nine justices, of course, when they, in fact, I'll take one step further back. When a case is argued, before then, the justices often haven't even discussed a case between themselves before they're argued. They've discussed them internally, but the Supreme Court works like nine separate law firms, okay, with one partner and then with four associates, and those are the law clerks for each justice, and they organize all their stuff internally. Then you have oral argument, where the justices largely speak to each other by speaking to and through the lawyers in front of them with their questions and comments. And then at the end of each week, when you're arguing cases, typically argued Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then on Friday, you have a weekly conference where the court handles various things. They vote on petitions for new cases later on. And one of the other things that they do is they take a preliminary vote, an initial vote, on the cases argued that week. There's only nine people in the room, the nine justices. In fact, the junior one gets stuck with all these duties. If anyone has an urgent message, all they can do is knock on the door. No one's allowed in. The junior justice has to actually get up from the table, walk over to the door, and get the note. If anyone wants water or coffee, it's the junior justice who has to get up and go around serving the water and coffee. And then also, as they're taking their votes that I'm about to describe, it's the junior justice who has to fill out the sheet to keep track of how that's going. So the meeting is led by the chief justice. He starts with each case they heard on giving his quick take, a couple minutes, on his theory as to how the court should decide the case. And then he casts his vote. And then they go down in order of seniority all the way to the junior justice, who then, who after he or she casts their vote, then in this case, right now, it's Justice Barrett because Justice Biden's pick has not yet joined the court, Justice Jackson. So then at that point, Justice Barrett would announce what the tally is. And then the senior most justice in the majority, which is the chief if he is in the majority, otherwise it would be, like in this case, Clarence Thomas as the longest serving, the senior associate chief justice, I'm sorry, the senior associate justice, the most senior justice in the majority then assigns the opinion to someone in that majority, either to himself or to someone else in the majority. And then that person starts actually writing an opinion. Sometimes it can be done in 30 days. One of the things that look legitimate about this opinion, or I guess under these circumstances, I would say authentic instead of legitimate, because it's so illegitimate what happened in this process, is 60 days. I mean, it looks like in this case, the case was argued on December 1. The timestamp on this opinion is February 10. That's about 70 days there. That would make sense for an opinion this long. It's 67 pages. That the justice spreads it to the chambers of the other eight justices. At that point, the number of people who have it, Alex, goes from five, the author and his four clerks, to 45, the other eight and each of their four clerks. Those are the only ones that you know actually have a copy of it at this point. I'm trying to think if there's a couple people who are administrative staff or something, but I don't think so. So I think we're at a universe of one of these 45. None of the justices would ever do something like this. And so it looks probable that one of their law clerks, so you're talking about a young, off-the-charts, brilliant lawyer, it's the biggest credential you can have in a legal career to have clerked for a Supreme Court justice. Someone taking that job who has taken a commitment to maintain at all costs to never reveal the secrets of the court, that you never talk about, it is your commitment to the country, to the rule of law. It is as big or bigger than your commitment as a lawyer when you're sworn in to maintain the secrets of your client. This is like a level beyond that, the secrets of the Supreme Court of the United States. Someone violated that oath-bound commitment in terms of taking this ultimate credential and instead putting themselves on a track where I still can't think of anything they could be criminally prosecuted for, but they would be disbarred. I mean, they would lose their law license and they wouldn't allow to do traffic ticket cases in this country for the rest of their life. So, a tremendous risk and just a profound betrayal to invade what the Constitution makes a process between these nine justices as they are deciding the affairs of our nation.
So unless we see someone who was unless we see something like a hacking or a someone took it to a the laptop repair shop in Delaware and took their laptop to a laptop repair shop in Delaware and just forgot about it, and the person got in there. And not to mention, they leaked it to a reporter at Politico, who is actually a pretty great reporter, which I don't think I ever say that, period. But Josh Gerstein is a guy's name who's atypically solid for really any sort of Beltway reporter. But he's gotten great scoops over the years and typically writes it more soberly than your average left-wing establishment media reporter. So someone would have had to have either ripped it off of a laptop and then happened to send it to maybe the best guy in town to write it up and having to have that presence of mind. Or this is one of those clerks in all likelihood, and there's 36 of them, and that was probably it. And that was probably one of the people who grabbed this document and then sent it out. And I'll tell you, Ken, some of the reaction online, even from those who do not share a politics, Jeffrey Toobin, who is a hysteric, I will say that, took a break for masturbating in front of his colleagues on Zoom to go on CNN to say, quote, "There has never been a leak of a vote, much less an actual opinion, much less in a case of this significance." And then he goes on to say, "It's a shattering experience for the justices, and I really don't know how the institution is going to recover." Oh, my goodness. That is intense. Is it really that level?
Yes, it is. It's unlikely to be the laptop repair shop, because I think you have to be a crackhead to forget that you had left your laptop there and abandon it. And then people eventually
you don't have to be, but
people eventually look at your naughty videos, and you better hope at that point that your father becomes president so that everyone can say the story doesn't exist, that it's some foreign disinformation plot. But and if you say that, by the way, you might be put in charge of a disinformation board at the Department of Homeland Security. So that could actually be a great career move for you.
Exactly. It's a great career trajectory.
Right. That's right. So it's, it's sometimes, right, exactly. But so no, they have their own IT department. All of these things are kept. There are such protocols in place to keep something like this from happening inadvertently. All these protocols in place to keep unauthorized people from seeing these documents. And the number of authorized people is, again, just like 45. It had to have been one of the clerks. And yes, I can't believe I'm saying that I agree with Jeffrey Toobin, because there are all sorts of things that Jeffrey Toobin does that I wouldn't want to be associated with. But I think he is correct on this point. It is that there will be entire books written on last night's leak, not the subject matter of the leak, but the fact that a leak from the Supreme Court happened. And let me tell you why, Alex, because this is all a process that until the moment it is released from the court, in a way, it's not real at all. It's like a stock price that actually doesn't matter until the moment you sell your share of stock, because the stock that you ultimately share, a stock that today for you might be $46 a share, you know, you could be selling it a week from now, it might only be worth 10, or it could be worth 100. There's so much that can change between its value right now and when it actually becomes a real value in dollars and cents at the moment you cash it in. A Supreme Court opinion works the same way. From that process we described, The authoring justice circulates it. At that point, a negotiation process begins. At that point, it's only the words of Sam Alito. It's only what Justice Alito thinks the decision should be. It only becomes a decision of the Supreme Court if at least four other justices will sign their name to it. And so during that process, I clerked for the Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court. Normally, that's a three-judge panel. But every now and then, you have what are called en banc courts, where it's all the judges of your court. And on the court I was, the Sixth Circuit in the Midwest, I mean, there are 16 judges. And so you have these draft opinions, and then you have a judge who says, I would love to sign. I'm not a fan of Part 4A of the opinion. Here are my suggested edits. If you can agree with these changes, I'll sign. If not, I don't think I can. And so you get these other eight justices, all of whom have an idea as to what the decision of the court should look like. It only becomes a Supreme Court majority opinion if the author successfully navigates the process where at least four other justices, if they can all agree on changes that don't scare each other off, it's a compromise work product. And that's what becomes the majority opinion that actually becomes the binding law in this country. The other justices end up either writing dissenting opinions or concurring opinions, or maybe they do some of all of the above. But there's a sausage making process that begins with the initial draft opinion, which means that what happened in this leak, among other things, Alex, is an attempt to intimidate, I would say just one, and we don't know which one justice on the majority. Right now, one other thing I'll say, this, I believe, means this had to have been a 5-4 decision.
Yeah.
Because then this becomes like Florida, Bush v. Gore in Florida in the 2000 presidential election, where you just need to turn one state. And if you do so, you actually change the outcome of the presidential election. So this looks like a target attempt to go after one justice. Rumors are saying they think it would be Justice Brett Kavanaugh, to just make him so scared, because it's hard to see how you could get to five without Kavanaugh. So I don't think the Chief Justice was on this at the outset. It looks like I think that he would concur, write an opinion that concurs that the specific Mississippi law at issue here is okay, is constitutional, but was going to dissent from overruling Roe v. Wade. So it looks like this is a targeted attempt to get Brett Kavanaugh to cave to liberal outrage and switch his vote so that Justice Alito's opinion becomes just a dissenting opinion, and some liberal opinion written by Breyer or Sotomayor or Kagan then becomes the majority opinion that preserves Roe v. Wade, and with it this ill-gotten, illegitimate idea of a constitutional right to abortion.
Ken, do we have any sense of if we'll get hard and fast answers to this, and if so, when? What do you think is going through the minds of the justices right now of the court?
We have no sense of what will happen next because there's no historical basis for this. And so none of the justices have ever dealt with this kind of a betrayal, not just of Sam Alito, but of the institution of the Supreme Court, of its role in the life of our nation. And so I don't know what I have no idea what they're going to do in that regard, because there's only so much you can do. I mean, you need these clerks, you need them working on this. You already have protocols and safeguards in place. So, but when someone has access to things of that nature, there's such a level of trust in being a Supreme Court law clerk that I don't know what you can do where they can still do the job that they do, assisting their justice without I don't know what you could take away to keep something like this from happening before. I also think, again, the fact that we have gone over two centuries of Supreme Court law clerks without anything of this nature ever happening before, is a once in two centuries betrayal. Something that maybe there's nothing you can do beyond each of the justices trying to be more careful during their interviewing process as to whether they are hiring someone who will betray them and their country and do so for political reasons. Because that's exactly what this is.
So let's get into the opinion itself, Ken. What is in it? Do you feel like it is well argued? What is the essence of what is being argued?
Well, again, as someone who has read hundreds of Alito opinions, I can't think of an opinion of his that I think is more finely written than what I read last night. And this is a 67-page majority opinion. That's about as long as they get. I mean, as I recall, Justice Scalia's Heller opinion on the Second Amendment in 2008, that was about 60 pages, I think a little shorter, I think 60 even. So this is a huge opinion, a mammoth opinion. It covers.
So I want to pause on that for a moment before you get into more, but it does speak to the authenticity of it. Also speaks to how seriously Justice Alito takes this opinion, that he knows this is one that is, of all the opinions he's written, this is the one that will be without a doubt the most significant, if it turns out. Maybe anyway, by the way, regardless of what happens next, but regardless of what happens next, it might be the most famous one he ever writes. But it is going to be, it will change America as we know it if this does become the majority opinion of the court. Go on, Ken. What's in it?
That's right. Well, the court makes 5 points. It starts, as is typical, part one, covers the history and development of whatever the subject matter is, and then also the litigation history on it. So in this case, he just spells out the history of abortion laws in America, mainly before Roe v. Wade. Having gotten into that history, part two then says, you know, the question we need to ask is whether there is a right in the Constitution that doesn't let states pass the kind of laws we were just talking about, something in the Constitution that doesn't allow this. And he unpacks that the way the Supreme Court defines constitutional rights, that this does not meet that standard. You read from part of it from a different part of the opinion. I think you might have been reading from page 5, which I had also put in my piece, where the test that the Supreme Court uses for identifying a right in the Constitution that is not spelled out in the text the way free speech is or the Second Amendment is that it must be a right that is deeply rooted in the history and tradition of the United States and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, meaning something that has been recognized as a constitutional right from the founding of the country and the adoption of the Constitution for all two centuries of that time, and something that is just central to our whole concept of what it means to live in a free society. And as he pointed out, he says, you know, we went for 180 years as a country without the Supreme Court thinking that abortion was such a right. It wasn't until the 1970s that all of a sudden the Supreme Court said this, not the 1790s, the 1970s. So he unpacks that test in part two and explains why this is not a constitutional right. But then in part three, he gets into stare decisis, the principle that as a general matter, when a legal issue has been decided, it should be adhered to unless there's a special justification for overruling it. And this is by far the longest court opinion I've ever seen on stare decisis, on what the factors are. And he walks through them and shows why each one does not apply here, like the workability of the precedent. Everyone acknowledges that the current framework for abortion, where it's about whether the unborn child is viable yet outside the room, so you have pre-viability restrictions that are different from post-viability restrictions. But of course, with medical science, viability gets earlier and earlier. It shows what a train wreck that has been. Settled reliance and expectation and the embracing of an issue by the American people, those are all factors. He said this has become more and more controversial over the years. The Supreme Court's decision in Roe did not settle this matter. The American people have not just accepted it and moved on. So it goes through all of these factors and shows that why stare decisis does not counsel in favor of retaining a decision that the court believes is so egregiously wrong that instead they should overrule it. And then in the next part, he gets into what I believe is going on here. And then he said, you know, then there's a whole separate reason that people say that once we have ruled on something that is so controversial, that it would be a blow to the credibility of our court to ever overrule that, that there's a special kind of precedent where once we have said it, we dare not ever revisit the issue because it's just too big of a deal. And then he spent that whole part talking about we can never allow that to keep us from doing our job, that if we screwed up the Constitution and we've done everything to try and figure out how to mitigate that damage, and the damage is just still ongoing, we can't let that get in the way of the duty that the Constitution assigns to us, and that is to faithfully interpret and apply the law the way it's written. And we need to accept our error and overrule our error. And then finally, he gets into, so who's going to make abortion decisions now? And he says it's got to go back to the way it was for 180 years in America, and that is that state lawmakers, state legislatures, will decide on abortion laws answerable to their own local voters, that they have to stand before every 2 or 4 or 6 years to reflect those people's priorities and values. And then the only federal judicial review of those decisions will be what's called rational basis review, just the baseline kind of legal review with no special protections that just makes sure that a law is reasonably related to advancing any sort of legitimate public interest. And he says, aside from that, that it's out of our hands. And it's a decision, and this is the bottom line takeaway, Alex. It is a decision that, and I'll quote the words where he puts it. This is about judicial humility. This is about unelected judges saying the Constitution does not give us the power to run your lives. You get to run your lives through your elected leaders. And the quote here is where he says, "It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives." And then goes on to quote Justice Scalia from years ago, who said, "The permissibility of abortion and the limitations upon it are to be resolved, like most important questions in our democracy, by citizens trying to persuade one another and then voting." And then Alito adds, "That is what the Constitution and the rule of law demand."
So, Ken, what does this mean for abortion law? Where does it go now if it does become the law of the land? And again, handicap the likelihood that this does become the law of the land. It seems like the intimidation tactic very well could backfire, but it's hard to see yet because you know the riots are going to get are going to break out. People are already protesting. People are already demanding court packing. The threats on America are going to be unbelievable, and I'll report some of those out later in the broadcast today, but they will continue and they will ramp up and they will get a lot of people animated. But do you believe this will become law? And if it does, then what does that mean for abortion rights?
Well, three parts to that. Will it become law? To do that, you would have to persuade both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the newest member of the court, since, again, Jackson isn't on the court yet. You would need to persuade Alito and his colleagues would have to persuade Kavanaugh and Barrett to stay on this opinion that they must have preliminarily agreed to join, and if so, it's up to them. It's up to Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Barrett to stand strong. I have to say, if they do not, if either one of them, I think all the pressure is going to be on Justice Kavanaugh. I think with Justice Barrett, it's just that she's brand new, but I think the pressure will be on Justice Kavanaugh. If he were to reverse his vote here, it would earn him a commentary in the history books that his reputation would never recover from. It would be, you know, the guy whose sworn duty is to uphold the Constitution is that he will do what he believes the Constitution requires unless you throw enough of a fit in a public protest, and then he'll change his idea on what the Constitution says. I cannot imagine a more searing indictment to ever be said about any member of the court. I can't imagine that's what Justice Kavanaugh would want his legacy for the rest of his life and in history to be, because this leak will be in the history books. And so any impact that it has on him or any justice, there'll be a paragraph on that in the history books. And I can't imagine that he would rather that be said about him than to say, and then the man did his duty with whatever his true view of what the Constitution was. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I think to minimize any pressure on any justice, and I say this in the piece that Breitbart has, that they should just issue the opinion now. However much editing it's gone through now, give it a once through today looking for typos or whatever, and I'm joking because I'm sure that was done long ago. Get this out within a day or two. Make this the majority opinion now. If other people are still working on a concurring opinion or a dissenting opinion, whatever. They can issue those whenever they're ready, but none of those carry the force of law. If this is what the opinion has, in a way, it already has the public impact as if it had been released officially. Just go ahead and release it officially. Take the pressure off by ending this case. Get the opinion out and make this Dobbs decision final. And I think it's critically important that that happen.
Ken, the court thus far has said that they have no comment on this. Does that surprise you?
I'm still there. I'm sure they're still dropping their jaw off the floor. They're speechless right now. It is, and I think no comment is, I'm not surprised, and I wouldn't be surprised if they keep to that until they hand out this decision. This is astounding. I mean, I'm trying to think of what sort of embarrassing.
So you think the no opinion could mean the no comment is no comment yet, because perhaps the nature of it is that wild. Okay, so a Supreme Court lawyer, Neil Katyal, who's a favorite of the MSNBC and CNN crowd, who seems like a very bright guy.
He's former deputy solicitor general. He is and a former clerk for Stephen Breyer. Katyal is brilliant. I've worked on a case with him before.
Yeah, and he seems like a Trump drove him crazy a little bit, but he's definitely someone to keep an eye on if you want to know sort of a establishment left-wing view.
Oh, yeah,
of
he's
this.
A liberal establishment. He is a big-time liberal establishment lawyer.
Right.
Yes.
So he had a he suggested yesterday that this is the exact hardline position that he had suggested the court was going to impose for the last 3 years, which that means that he thinks that the decision itself is very much in line with what the expectation should have been. And this is striking to me, Ken, because it shows you that those who know this issue frontwards and back, they're struck less by the opinion itself than by the leak. And I think that's very significant to point out for, you know, the fourth or fifth time in the segment. But that really seems to be where most of the drama lies in Supreme Court circles. Maybe for the rest of us, where ultimately how the opinion was leaked will be secondary to the opinion itself. Only time will tell in that regard. But according to those who follow the Supreme Court for a living, it does seem like the leak itself is what's overwhelming.
Yes, absolutely. This is one of the greatest instances of President Trump keeping a promise that he made to the American people. He said that he would appoint justices who would vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. Other presidents have promised that and not delivered on it. Now, I think that a couple of President Trump's picks to the courts did not vote the way he thought they would vote and that he had hoped they would vote on other issues. I'm thinking of matters of immigration and whatnot. But he appeared to have done in the vetting process of identifying someone's judicial philosophy, not specific issues, but just how they look at the law, how they look at the Constitution. It looks like the vetting process that the lawyers under him put in place did a fair job on identifying people whose view of the Constitution would be like we're seeing reflected here. In this case, justices who would say the word abortion never shows up in the Constitution. It's not my job to invent rights that the American people have not invented through putting them in the Constitution with a constitutional amendment. And when we find that we have misinterpreted the Constitution, some things become so egregious that we need to admit our error, overrule it, and restore it to the democratic process. And so it looks like President Trump did exactly what he said he was going to do. People should have recognized that that was going to be the case. And so, sure, ever since 2017, everyone should have expected that this day would come if there were enough vacancies on the court.
Ken, I want to ask you again about what is the future now of abortion rights in America. Will the decision go back to the states? I'm guessing the answer is a clear yes. What does that mean? And where could it go from here? Does this mean the states are, is there going to be rules and laws on the books for all the states that are in place that will take effect? Or will states be tasked with drafting new legislation? Will the U.S. Congress try to get involved quickly and try to put something together that they could pass perhaps before the Republicans presumably take control? Where do you think things go?
It means that for each of your listeners, if this becomes the rule of law, if this becomes a final decision, which again, I would hope the court would make it official right away now, is that each person now would have the right to have their values reflected at the state level through their state lawmakers on this issue. Some states would be pro-life, and states like Oklahoma, South Dakota, et cetera, you could expect to become pro-life. California, New York, you're going to have no trouble getting abortion on demand. Many other states maybe are going to be restrictions on abortion, perhaps like late third trimester abortions, once a child is at the age where they can feel pain inside the womb, those sorts of issues. Even then, though, Alex, under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, interstate travel is a constitutional right. So let's say you live in a pro-life state, but that is borders a pro-abortion state. If you drive 2 or 3 hours, you would still be able to get abortion on demand. So I guess for the people who on the left who say that that would be the end of the world, how many abortions does a person plan on having where they can't afford, you know, 1 2-hour trip from Indiana over to neighboring Illinois?
So here's a question, though. Do you see any potential laws put into place, which I don't know if this would be constitutional or if it would go against federalism in general, but could you have a law in place where a resident or a citizen of a certain state cannot travel for an abortion to another state?
That would be unconstitutional, because there is a federal constitutional right to interstate travel. So therefore, no state is permitted to pass a law that deprives someone of their ability to exercise a federal constitutional right. So that's protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. So any attempted restriction on that would be struck down by the same court that would strike down Roe v. Wade.
If Republicans are able to take the Congress in overwhelming numbers and take the presidency in 2024, could they draft legislation that would perhaps provide more federal limitations on abortion, or would that be subject to the same decision as the one that's overturning Roe v. Wade?
Great question. That gets into a separate constitutional domain, because there are arguments that too would be litigated. That gets into all the provisions in the Constitution are either an authority provision or a liberty provision. They're either provisions about the powers of government or about the liberty, the rights of individuals. That would get into the authority side. It would be Congress's power under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. A conservative reading of the Commerce Clause, which gives Congress power to regulate interstate commerce, a conservative reading of the Commerce Clause says that unless interstate commerce is happening, that the federal government shouldn't be able to pass laws along those lines. I mean, so some of the federal restrictions on abortion on the books right now, those are predicated on a broad reading of the Commerce Clause. And it was also reinforced by the idea that this had been declared a federal right. And so the federal Congress had a stake in being able to regulate a federal right. If it's no longer a federal right and you're left just with the Commerce Clause, and then the Commerce Clause is being read narrowly, you are more and more just empowering states to make these decisions to reflect the views and values of their local citizens.
Noted, Marsha Blackburn is our second guest on the podcast today, who has a unique perspective being the only pro-life woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but she also gives some commentary on some of the other big news items of the day, including record-setting border crossings, at least apprehensions, which does indicate crossings in general, and we get her thoughts on the new Ministry of Truth, which really is happening, as far as we know, as of now, all that in the interview. Senator, I know we had a lot to talk about when we booked you for the show. We got food shortages. We've got perhaps a record level of people immigrating illegally through our southern border. We got a Ministry of Truth. I'm going to get your take on all that, but I'm sure you're aware. Massive breaking news that occurred last night with this leak of what appears to be a opinion that would perhaps be a majority opinion that would overturn Roe versus Wade from Justice Alito. Again, all the details are spotty. We're not going to have anything set in stone for a little while, but everyone seems to know what they're looking at, or think they know what they're looking at. What are your thoughts on all this so far?
Well, first of all, I think we have to realize this was a draft opinion from February, if it is indeed an accurate document, and it's going to be up to the Chief Justice to protect the integrity of the court, to work through the investigation. I'm certain that he already has the other justices in his chambers, and this will follow closely with meetings with their clerks and also with the FBI. But we have to protect the institutions. But bear in mind, this is what the Democrats do when they do not get their way. They go to the media, and it doesn't matter if it was when I chaired the select committee on looking at infant lives and the sale of the baby body parts when I was in the House. What did they do? They would leak information to the media. They would coach the witnesses because they want things to go their way. And if they can't get it done legislatively, and if they are not going to get it done in the courts, they attack the courts. Chuck Schumer is the one who started this action of filibustering judges. It is the Democrats that are wanting to do away with the filibuster rule in the Senate. It is the Democrats that are trying to pack the court, that are trying to federalize elections, that are trying to push for D.C. statehood. And they want to do this because they are focused on an outcome. And the outcome is implementing their agenda, which is a socialist, Marxist-bending agenda, which is going to take away your freedoms and give those power to the government. And these are people who are elitist, who say, I'm in control. We want all the power. And we have to realize this is the way they operate. And they're going to do this over and over and over so that they can disrupt how our democratic republic works, that they can do away with the Constitution, they can do away with your freedoms, and they control your life. That is what they want.
One thing that is striking to me is the immediate reaction to kind of overlook the leak itself and overlook the decision, which, again, millions of people saw coming, given the nature of the court politically, and to go straight for the we're going to fight, the fight rhetoric from Gavin Newsom and Elizabeth Warren. And we had Fetterman, who may or may not end up joining you in the Senate after the November election, John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, saying abortion is sacred. It's amazing the extent to which the left insists, and it's not just the left, it's really the mainstream Democrat position, that the ability to slaughter the unborn in the womb is even more important than the integrity of our Supreme Court and our democracy.
Yes, you know, they have said a woman's right to choose, even though, bear in mind, 2 weeks ago they couldn't define woman.
Yeah, good
but
call.
Today, they're out there and they're saying, no, it is a woman's right to choose. What this lawsuit and this argument before the Supreme Court was not to outlaw abortion. It was just to say the proper place for these decisions is at the state level, and thereby the state should have the ability to make the decision as to how they're going to move forward. Now, that is federalism 101. And things that are not enumerated in the Constitution, they go to the states, and the states make the decisions. That's why you have the state legislatures that are in charge of elections. It's why state legislatures set their rates of local and state taxation. It is why state legislatures take the lead on issue after issue, like schools and school boards and curriculum, because that is federalism. Now, I think that the left is so wrong to go after saying this would outlaw abortion, because that is inaccurate. And the more people realize that, then the better it is for saying, you know what, maybe the states are the proper place for this. And quite frankly, I think more people are going to come our direction on that decision of saying, yes, indeed, the states are the proper place for deciding how this state, this group of citizens would choose to address that issue. But, sure. You know, the left doesn't stop at that, Alex. What they do, I'm the only pro-life female on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And what they do is try to go after the personal destruction attack.
Yeah.
They go after haranguing, because you can't be a conservative woman in their mind, and you cannot be fully recognized and your opinion matter unless you submit to the leftist agenda. And the leftist agenda is abortion on demand up to the last minute.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the mainstream position. One thing that was one of the more surprising takes that I saw was actually from the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who suggested that if this opinion does become law, it wouldn't just be an attack on women, it would be an attack on all Americans. Senator, the whole rationale for abortion rights my entire life has been that to restrict abortions at all would be an attack on women. Why is it now an attack on all Americans? This goes back to your point earlier that they don't know what a woman is anymore, I guess, all of a sudden. This seemed to happen overnight. Nancy Pelosi's 1,000 years old, and she just decided now that she doesn't know the difference, I guess?
It's really quite astounding, isn't it, that all of a sudden it's an attack on all Americans for the Supreme Court to issue a ruling that the Democrats don't agree with. But see, they're going to use this to say, we have to pack the court, and we have to do it immediately. We have to pack the federal bench, which of course they're trying to do. They're forcing older judges and justices, as they did with Breyer, to retire so they can put in progressives in those spots. And see, you know, Alex, at the federal bench level, whether it's the district court or the appellate court, we have progressive activists, socialist activists that are coming forward who have not spent 1 minute as a judge, not a county judge, a city judge, a local judge. They have never had any experience on the bench, but this Biden White House is putting these activists forward to take a position on our federal district and appellate courts.
Senator Marsha Blackburn is with me, Republican from Tennessee. So, Senator, where do you think this one goes next before we dig into some of the other topics that are out there that I do want to touch on with you? But are you concerned about what's going to happen here, because you know the activist crowd is going to be really activated here, and there is a level of intimidation that they're trying to pull off? Or are you optimistic and you focus on just perhaps the decision itself, and it could end up being a net benefit for particularly the unborn, but I think America in general?
Well, I do think that what you're going to see is the American people are going to say, I have to tell you quite honestly, that the American people are sick of all of this fighting that the left is doing, regularly just going after issue after issue, taking to the streets, and all of the protesting and the unrest. And what they would like to see is some civility. And what we have to do is realize this is up to Chief Justice Roberts to assemble the justices, to find out what happened, to meet with the clerks. There's a very small circle of people that would have access to a draft opinion. So they are going to get to the bottom of this. We need to support the Chief Justice and the integrity of the court as they go through this process. And then as we move forward, my hope is that the American people will realize that it is important who wins elections. It is important the people that are put forward to take these positions on these federal courts at the district, the appellate, and the Supreme Court level.
Okay, Senator, I want to turn focus a little bit, and let's talk about an exclusive story at Breitbart News. With 201,000 migrant apprehensions in April, that is a number that is almost hard to fathom. 200,000 taken into custody. We estimate the number that it gets taken into custody is somewhere between a third and a half of the total numbers of crossers, which means that probably if that number holds, and again, it could vary month to month, but that means that 200,000 to 300,000, 200,000 to 400,000 migrants could have come in illegally and entered the country and will be here, as far as we know, for as long as they feel like it and as long as they feel like they can make a living here. Very disturbing, and it seems like the Department of Homeland Security in particular is getting more focused on, I'm presuming, people like me, because they now have a Ministry of Truth, Ministry of Misinformation, which, as we know, is any opinion they don't like at this point. I don't even know where to begin. It's so alarming and shocking in every sense of the word. What are your thoughts on any of it?
What we have to realize is that the left is using the media to control the narrative. They only want you to know what they want you to know, and they have so narrowed the funnel for information that if it is not their version of a story, they're going to call it disinformation. And I find it so interesting that the DGB sounds a lot like the KGB from the old Soviet days. Putin was a KGB agent. But here is what we have to look at. They want that total control. They know that we have held these hearings, many of them with a bipartisan agreement, that big tech is out of control, that they are censoring, that they are endangering lives. They know that we're moving forward with children's online privacy, with consumer privacy, with Section 230 reforms, and they can't stand it. And we're moving forward because it's what the American people demand. So they've said, we're not going to let you do this. We're going to put in the Disinformation Governance Board, and we, the federal government, are going to preempt whatever it is that social media says, and we're going to tell you what is and is not accurate. Now, as we know, the Broadway singing actress who is going to be the DGB head is someone who thinks Christopher Steele is awesome. She thinks that it was a Russia hoax all around Hunter Biden and the laptop. She does not like Donald Trump. She does not like conservatives. So, with that world view, what position do you think she's going to take? Is she going to make a decision that is going to be fair that is going to be look at both sides, and the answer to that is no. She has an agenda, and her agenda is to shut up conservatives.
It seems like that's her history, but they're taking the approach that this is going to be totally neutral and this is going to be focused on foreign disinformation. But remember that they referred to, for example, our political editor, the left did, Emma Jo Morris, who broke all the Hunter Biden laptop scoops a couple years ago. They referred to her as a Russian asset, even though she's a Canadian person who's adopted America as her country and is
right, and this is
has no connection to Russia whatsoever, and yet she'll be called a foreign actor.
Right, I have written Homeland Security about this because this should be immediately disbanded. And what I'm trying to see is, of course, they're not providing any transparency on this, so we're seeking transparency. And my letter over to Secretary Mayorkas calls on him to disband this, but also ask him specifically, what authority does Ms. Jankowicz and this board have, and what resources are they using to fund this? Because we can eliminate that funding that would go to this type board. And what outside groups are pushing for this? What outside groups have participated in this? Because we know with this latest Supreme Court confirmation that it was Demand Justice and the Arabella groups, supported groups, that were sure, very active in pushing for Judge Jackson to be elevated to the Supreme Court. What they want are progressives on the court who will rubber stamp the left's agenda and let them control your life from daylight to dark, federalize elections, make D.C. a state. They are wanting all of this. And it is going to take an activist judiciary. We are seeing what happens when you have activists in roles of authority, and I hope they disbar. If the person is someone who is an attorney, I hope they are disbarred. Otherwise, they should be held to account in every possible way for what they have done to attack the integrity of the Supreme Court.
Senator, Joe Biden's having a tough time, and his new tactic is to try to blame Republicans for all of his failures. This has been the approach. It's been pushed by the White House, the same White House that is defending the new Ministry of Truth that they've created. It seems like they're in a bit of a messaging crisis, but is there any sense from the Republican Senate side that there's any place where he wants to find common ground with you, perhaps get something passed, or is it merely about hostility at this point?
The closer we get to the midterm elections and the more in the tank they realize that they are, then I think that it is what we are seeing is they are pushing further and further to the left. They're trying to make that leftist base active, and they need to appease them as they go into this election cycle. We have offered regularly to work with our colleagues on issues that are important to the American people, whether it is the big tech issues, whether it's caring for veterans, funding our military, making certain that we get resources to Ukraine, that we push back on the Communist Chinese Party, but there seems to be less willingness.
It's just so striking to me because it's hard to figure out where to put your focus at this point, because you look at the Ministry of Truth, you look at the absurd defense by Alejandro Mayorkas of the Ministry of Truth, saying that he doesn't question the objectivity of Nina Jankowicz, despite the fact that she's been on the side of numerous left-wing causes, including mislabeling the Hunter Biden laptop as Russian disinformation. You've got the border numbers that I just mentioned. Now we're going to be thrown into this fight over Roe versus Wade. And abortion rights. And we're not even talking about the Bidenflation. And as I noted earlier, there's a global food shortages that are being tracked by S&P Global. This is something that was somewhat of a surprise. The problems are just adding up, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of solutions being put forward by Washington. Are there any kernels of hope, Senator, that you're seeing?
My hope is that the Democrats will cross the aisle, and whether it's dealing with the Title 42 issues at the border or is dealing with some of the inflation issues, which are driven by energy cost, that they will come to the table and work with us on these issues. These affect everyday Americans that are working hard to make ends meet. And when you go to the grocery store and you see the escalation rate and the cost of the price of milk and coffee and bread and hamburger meat and these things that you're going to use every single day in your home, you know that it is not just an 8% inflation rate, it's closer to a 20% if you put those all in the hopper and shake them up and toss out a rate. The food costs are elevating, and this is of concern to parents as they look at kids being home for the summer, as they're looking at trying to get in visits to family members and grandparents during these summer weeks, sending children to camps for summer experiences. All of this is going to cost more.
So, Senator, what's the plan for the Senate if you, the Republicans, take control again? Will there be investigations? You've got Mayorkas out there admitting Title 42 is going to generate a more of an influx of illegal immigration to our southern border. It seems like something that should be an impeachable offense from my vantage point. Again, that doesn't start with you all in the Senate, but I mean, it seems like a major thing. If we don't have a sense of things, will there be an investigation into the Supreme Court leak? What is there that can be done when you guys take power inevitably?
It is up to the chief. When it comes to the Supreme Court leak, that is going to be the Chief Justice. And it sounds as if he's already working with the FBI. We need to support the Chief Justice as he goes through this process of ferreting out exactly what happened and making certain that the integrity of the court is protected. But bear in mind, as I said earlier, the goal of the progressives who are now taking over the Democrat Party, their goal is to upend and to do away with our institutions, our Constitution, the rule of law, as our first principles. They want to do away with these things. And now they feel like if they can attack the integrity of the court, then it gives them the permission to tear things up and rebuild it the way they want it. The American people just need to stand with us, with conservatives, as we push to make certain that we protect the constitutionality, the rule of law, the integrity of our systems in this country.
Senator Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, thanks so much for all the time.
Awesome.
Awesome is right. I got American parts. Thanks to producers Haley and Greg Eben and Robert Marlowe helps me pick topics. And thanks to all of you who've spread the word about the show. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you tomorrow.